From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
From ABC News World Headquarters in New York, this is World News Tonight with Peter Jennings.
Nearly a week has passed since the passing of Peter Jennings, and in that time his memory has been duly honored. He was suave, he was cool, he was exacting, unflinching, indefatigable, and at moments of genuine drama, genuinely remarkable. From the fall of the Berlin Wall.
Someone actually reached up and handed me a small piece of the wall that they had chipped away. It's those small moments that make up this extraordinary day.
To the destruction of the Twin Towers.
It is a tragedy that has revealed itself before the eyes of millions of people in the country watching on television.
To the failure of his own flesh.
As some of you now know, I have learned in the last couple of days that I have lung cancer. I will continue to do the broadcast. On good days, my voice will not always be like this.
But after April 5th, we heard his voice no longer. On that evening, ABC News lost its anchor, and so did tens of millions of viewers who depended on Jennings not just for the Daily Report, but for all that the iconic American news superstar represents. In the worst of national moments, the anchorman's authority and celebrity convert to trust, imposing a sense of calm in the midst of chaos. War, terror, assassinations, space catastrophe, that's when an anchor takes hold, keeping the society moored to the sandy bottom. So it was fascinating in the past week to note the obituary within the obituary. Many of Peter Jennings' eulogists, from the Dallas Morning News to the Philadelphia Daily News to the New York Times, seemed eager to bury with him the role of anchorman altogether. Yes, Jennings' death, hard upon Tom Brokaw's retirement and Dan Rather's ignominious reassignment, changed the face of dinner hour. Yes, declining ratings suggest that they were the last generation of press card demigods. And yes, the days of broadcast news and broadcasting itself are numbered. But to coin a phrase, let's not be too quick to kill the messenger, because they still have work to do.
This is the CBS Evening News with Bob Schieffer.
This is NBC Nightly News with Brian Williams.
Not to mention Wolf Blitzer, Britt Hume, Elizabeth Vargas, Lester Holt, and scores of others. Shall we assume that as viewers migrate from the airwaves to cable to the internet, that the human connection will be made obsolete, that news consumers will stop relying on favorites? Surely the net will expand our options and fragment audiences. But especially when crisis triggers that fearsome sensation of being cast adrift, what are the chances that we will suddenly forsake the security of an anchor?
Good evening, I'm Charles Gibson. And as Peter would say, the news goes on.
Yes, it does. And so does the mysterious power of familiarity. Google News and Wikipedia are all well and good, but the medium is more than the message. It's the messenger, too. The news this week also included the death of John H. Johnson, the publishing mogul behind both Ebony and Jet magazines. Johnson, who died Monday at the age of 87, will be remembered not only for the long-enduring magazines themselves, read and remembered by so many, but also for those magazines' impact on Black America. When young John Johnson founded Negro Digest in 1942 with $500 borrowed against his mom's furniture, Condoleezza Rice wasn't close to being born, and Jim Crow wasn't close to being dead. For Black Americans, racism wasn't an insidious lingering vestige. It was an explicit, degrading, often violent daily reality. And in that environment, the 24-year-old entrepreneur decided to do something radical and revolutionary. In Negro Digest, he was determined to make being a Negro normal.
And what he was reflecting was that people were leading ordinary lives. They were going to work every day, coming home, feeding their children, you know, doing the things that other people did.
Jeanette Dates is the dean of Howard University's John H. Johnson School of Communications.
And the normalcy of it was a part of the appeal, so that you didn't feel the awkwardness of constantly being held up as someone who was different. That was a part, too. So there were all sorts of messages that were conveyed by his publication over almost 60 years.
That may not sound like a monumental achievement, but given the times, it really was.
Pamela Newkirk, author of Within the Veil, Black Journalists, White Media, says that long before the civil rights movement, the black power movement of the 60s, and the identity politics of later generations, Johnson recognized the political, cultural, and not incidentally commercial implications of black self-image.
You know, I don't know if you recall Dr. Kenneth Clark, as part of the Brown v. Board decision, they used his doll study. And what that doll study showed is that most black girls preferred white dolls over black dolls. And, you know, it's almost not worth arguing that part of the reason of that were the normal portrayals of African Americans at that time, the normal portrayals of what is beautiful. So these ideals that were firmly set in both black and white minds was something that Johnson went a long way towards dismantling.
The heart and soul of Johnson Publishing Company is Ebony, introduced in 1945 as a sort of black life magazine. It was fluffy, non-confrontational, and bourgeois, filled with celebrities and hokey aspirationalism. And it was very quickly a cash cow, financing the 1951 startup of Reader's Digest like Jet Magazine, not to mention a distribution company, a vast direct mail operation, the Fashion Fair cosmetics subsidiary, and a book division. Ebony also, over the years, became a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy, immersing itself in middle-class ideals for a burgeoning black middle class that didn't at first behave like a middle class, until it coalesced as one under the unabashedly commercial values John H. Johnson helped cultivate. But if Johnson was first and foremost a businessman, he understood he was in the journalism business, and he made sure he delivered. Philip Dixon is chair of the journalism department at Howard.
Before there was a BET, before there was an internet, before long-distance phone calls were cheap, the only way, if you were an African-American and you didn't get the Pittsburgh Courier and those newspapers, to stay on top of and understand what was happening to African-Americans around the country and what kind of progress people were making or not making, was to read his publications.
In the 60s and 70s, some bristled at the essential optimism of Ebony and Jet, deeming it irrelevant or worse. Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist Clarence Page of the Chicago Tribune was one of them, but he has since reevaluated.
The younger generation, my generation, I was in college at the time in the late 60s, would make fun of Ebony and Jet for being so bourgeois and being so middle class. In other words, express the values of our parents. Ha, ha, ha. I still secretly dream that someday Ebony would choose me as one of their Bachelors of the Year, because the Bachelors of the Year were cool. These were guys who had their own home, their own Jaguar, good jobs, were living a great life, but they were also going to church. They were leading roles of leadership in their communities. These were very positive stories, and this was at a time when the mainstream headlines were talking about riots in the streets, black power militancy.
Furthermore, as a consumer product, heavy politics didn't particularly sell. Johnson's maiden publication, Negro Digest, eventually evolved into Black World, a magazine of commentary that Johnson had to fold in the mid-70s due to fatal unprofitability. Ed Lewis, publisher of Essence magazine and longtime Johnson friend, recalls how that decision did not sit well among certain black activists.
And he tells a story that when they were protesting outside of the Johnson building about his decision to close the magazine, he called some of the protesters in and listened to them about why he should keep the magazine going. And then he said, stop. He asked several of the persons there, he said, I want to know your names. What he did was then tap into his computer with respect to whether they were subscribers. They were not subscribers. You know what he told them? You can leave my office.
Johnson showed them the door. He might have instead shown them his archive. Of special interest might have been a 1955 issue of Jet. featuring the open casket photo of 14-year-old Emmett Till, who had been murdered after supposedly whistling at a white woman outside a Mississippi grocery. That shocking image, seen in nearly a million black homes because Jet was so assiduously mainstream, is widely credited for helping galvanize the civil rights movement. But if one photograph 50 years ago was for millions of Americans a defining moment of grim confirmation, it wasn't an especially surprising act of magazine journalism. It did what courageous journalism does by shedding light on the ills of society, and it created such an uproar that it reversed what was then a decline in Jet's circulation. It was, in other words, in publishing terms, absolutely normal.
The Guardian newspaper reported this week that Nick Sophocleous was staying at his girlfriend's flat in North Kensington on July 21st when she called to alert him that suspects in the London bombing were holed up just across the street. But darn it, his camcorder was dead, so he charged the battery for an agonizingly long 20 minutes, catching the suspects on tape just as they left their building in their underwear, surrounded by the law. His images were beamed around the world, netting him a nice piece of change. So we want you, our listeners, to do that for us. Catch some sound of a media curiosity or outrage that seems to fit our show and send it to us. You'll have instant fame, but this being public radio, there won't be a nice piece of change. Sorry about that. But if you're still interested, you can go to onthemedia.org to learn where and how to send that sound. And while you're at it, send us an email or check out our transcripts, MP3 downloads, and podcast, also at onthemedia.org. Coming up, journalists weigh whether to give terrorists their 15 minutes of fame and Sunday's must-worship TV event.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This Sunday, some of the Christian right's biggest names are gathering at Two Rivers Baptist Church in Nashville to rally in support of Supreme Court nominee John Roberts. The event, nationally telecast to churches and broadcast on Christian cable and satellite networks, is known as Justice Sunday 2, God Save the United States and This Honorable Court. Faithful listeners may remember the first Justice Sunday back in April, dubbed Stopping the Filibuster Against People of Faith. This weekend's sequel features such luminaries as Prison Fellowship founder Chuck Colson, former Senator Zell Miller, House Majority Leader Tom DeLay, Focus on the Family founder James Dobson, and MC Tony Perkins, president of the Family Research Council. For a preview of the big event, we phoned Jeff Charlotte, research scholar at NYU's Center for Religion and Media. He says we should expect an evening of speeches heavy on rhetoric about one of the Christian right's favorite themes,
which is the idea that Christians in America are an embattled, victimized minority. And in this case, since they have John Roberts as a hero, they have a sort of a single man who is battling against the odds. They have a character for the narrative. It's been framed by Focus on the Family and the Family Research Council as really the sort of mother of all battles. And there's an emphasis constantly that this will directly affect you and your life for the rest of your life. Tony Perkins himself has said that this is the biggest fight Family Research Council has really taken on during his career.
You mentioned Tony Perkins. Justice Sunday, too, seems to be his baby, and he's the president of the Family Research Council. So who is this guy, and what about the Family Research Council?
Well, the Family Research Council is very closely related to Dr. James Dobson's focus on the family. It sort of grew out of Dobson's work in 1983. Tony Perkins is a former Louisiana state legislator who really made his name in the Christian right by getting passed in Louisiana a law called the Covenant Marriage Law, and this is a law to make divorce extremely difficult. So he used that to try and catapult himself to the U.S. Senate in 2002, was unsuccessful, and as a consolation prize got the helm of the Family Research Council, and in 3 years has proven a very skillful organizer. The idea is to politicize the church. That's very explicitly the project, and they've been terrific at it.
And yet the media machine that was developed by Perkins is different from that of James Dobson, head of Focus of the Family, and that sensibility is reflected in Justice Sunday, too.
Absolutely. James Dobson's Focus on the Family has a tremendous radio network, publications, and so on, and the primary consumers are women and mothers, whereas the Family Research Council, if you even look at their self-presentation, it's a much sterner presentation. It's burgundy colors, the kind of colors you might find in a traditional man's den or study. This is much more oriented toward a male sensibility, toward pastors. Justice Sunday, too, in a sense, is a program that is being developed for pastors of local churches who will then organize their churches. I asked a representative of a Family Research Council, I said, did you have a real sense that a lot of legislators watch this, and do you think that's going to happen again? And she said to me that that wasn't so important, because last time pastors watched the show, got their churches involved, their churches called their congressmen, their senators, and a week or two later, Family Research Council is hearing back from these legislators saying, okay, you've got our attention. And right now you can already get something called the Senate Action Pack from Family Research Council. And after Justice Sunday, they're going to encourage everybody to buy Save the Court kits.
I guess we can follow up simply by finding out how many of these message packs they've sent out.
That will be a good measure of success. But there is a lot of spin in terms of how effective this is, because they can't advertise that this is targeted to pastors. They need to emphasize the populism of it. And you see that even in the music of the promotions, it's almost like they're announcing a wrestling bout. Justice Sunday 2, calling it number 2 like that, like a sequel to a movie. All this is designed to sort of put out the idea that this is almost summer entertainment. This is a blockbuster.
Justice Sunday is back. Now the Supreme Court is on the line. Presidents shape policy for a few years, but Supreme Court justices impact our culture for generations. Watch Justice Sunday 2 and let your voice be heard on Supreme Court nominee John Roberts.
Now, of course, it has this focused audience that they're really trying to get to, but they want everyone to think, hey, this is for me. Everything is going to be in the second person, you, what you can do, how you can be involved. When I spoke to the Family Research Council, I said, how did you measure the success of Justice Sunday 1? And they were a little squishy on how they measured their success. They trumpeted the 61 million homes that had seen Justice Sunday 1.
But we know that that number is a bit misleading. That's how many houses were reached, not necessarily how many people tuned in.
Exactly. And it's hard to know whether that's a deliberate misstatement. I asked them to clarify, and they repeated 61 million homes. And I said, surely you mean 61 million homes were able to see it? And they said, well, that's the number we have, is we were given 61 million homes.
That's our story, and we're sticking to it.
That's our story, and we're sticking to it. And I think they recognize that there is going to be a certain number of media outlets who are going to buy that story and publicize it without recognizing that that would mean almost everyone in America watched Justice Sunday, which, of course, was not the case.
But it's really for the organizers, not necessarily for the grassroots. So it doesn't matter whether they reach 61 million or 6 million.
I think 6 million would be just fine, and I think 6 million would have, as they want it to, a tremendous impact on politics.
Well, Jeff, thank you so much.
Thanks, Brooke.
Jeff Charlotte is a research scholar at the Center for Religion and Media at New York University and editor of the website therevealer.org.
The Federal Communication Commission's new hire is likely to please Tony Perkins. On Monday, the trade publication Media Week broke the story that the FCC has added Penny Nance to its Office of Strategic Planning and Policy Analysis as an advisor. Todd Shields wrote the Media Week story, and he joins us now. Todd, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
First of all, who is Penny Nance, and do you have any idea what she was hired to do?
Well, Penny Nance is an activist for a lot of right-wing and Christian causes. She founded a group called Kids First Coalition, which says it works to protect children and invites members to contact Congress on issues such as abortion and pornography. And she's been a board member of a group called Concerned Women for America, which describes its mission as helping to bring biblical principles into all levels of public policy. Now, at the FCC, it seems, although people there won't confirm it directly to me, but it seems as if she'll be advising FCC Chairman Kevin Martin on issues surrounding broadcast indecency, TV and radio alike.
Todd, now you are in the possession of a letter that Penny Nance, among others, was a signatory to, a letter to President Bush in the early part of the year. Tell me about that.
The letter was written in January, and it asked President Bush to appoint a new chairman for the FCC who, in the letter's words, understands the indecency problem. And the letter called for, quote, repeated and expanded fines until broadcasters understand they are not above the law.
Is it unusual for a federal regulatory agency to be hiring people who are clearly advocates for a certain political ideology?
The FCC says it hires people with this title, special advisors, people with certain expertise, quite often. But there's a difference between possessing some technical expertise that the agency would seek, be it in law or in how gizmos work, and the kind of focus that Penny Nance has had, which is more or less broad-based advocacy.
Now, we have seen in a variety of regulatory agencies the hiring of people who are, you know, come from a particular ideological bent, and I would say in the Bush administration, the particulars are a Christian religious right political bent. Is there a reason for us to be nervous about these hires, either in the FCC or anywhere else?
Well, it depends on where you sit. The Republican Party runs all three branches of government in Washington right now, and a big part of their support is the conservative, Christian, family-oriented right wing. So if you lean that way in your politics, you're not concerned. You're encouraged that people like Penny Nance are working and helping the FCC devise its policy. If you're a First Amendment lawyer, you're probably a little concerned about this, thinking that producers are going to be trimming their sails for fear of potential FCC fines. So it depends on how you think about those issues.
Well, what about the sail trimming to date? Have you seen any evidence that Hollywood has been put on notice by this hiring or by any other developments in the Kevin Martin FCC?
Not the Kevin Martin FCC per se. In what's gone on over the last year and a half from the FCC, yes. The agency levied nearly $8 million in fines in 2004, and that was a big increase from previous years. Now, Martin's not proposed a single fine in his probably about 5 months now as chairman, and some look at that hiatus and proposing fines and say, well, that's because Hollywood's trimmed its sails. It could also be because Martin's getting up to speed. He right now works with two Democrats and two Republicans, including himself, on the commission. The White House hasn't appointed the members that need to be on that to have a full five-member commission. It would give Martin a 3-2 Republican majority, which is traditional. So whether the absence of fines means Hollywood's trimming its sails or Martin's still getting up to speed, we'll have to see.
What's your sense? Do you think this is the calm before the storm?
Yeah, I think it is. I think that sooner or later, the Enforcement Bureau is going to come up with a batch of complaints. And we still have waiting from last year the final adjudication of some of the big, well-noticed proposed fines, including the $550,000 in proposed fines for the famous Super Bowl incident. The network, CBS, and its owner, Viacom, have asked the FCC to reconsider its decision to levy that fine. So Kevin Martin needs to make a decision on that, and I can't imagine he'll say, oh, we were just kidding, there will be no fine. So all these should be coming out in coming months, I would think.
All right. Well, Todd, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Todd Shields is the Washington correspondent for Media Week. On July 28th, ABC's Nightline ran an interview conducted by independent Russian journalist Andrei Babitsky with Chechen rebel leader Shamil Basayev.
He is a stone-cold killer whose very acts define him. The 2002 Moscow theater hostage-taking and massacre. 129 dead, hundreds more injured. The Beslan school hostage-taking and massacre. Nearly 400 dead,
more than 700 injured.
Okay, I admit I'm a bad guy, a bandit, a terrorist. So I'm a terrorist, but what would you call them?
Koppel concluded the program by explaining his reason for defying Russia's wishes in giving national airtime to a self-described terrorist.
Freedom of speech is never an issue when a popular person expresses an acceptable point of view. It is of real value only because it guarantees us access to the unpopular, espousing the unacceptable. Then we can reject or accept it, condemn it or embrace it. No one should have the authority to make that decision for us. Not our government, and certainly not somebody else's.
Nightline's broadcast prompted the Russian government to revoke Russian accreditations for all ABC journalists, which isn't surprising. Russia is not the first nation to try to keep the media from giving terrorists FaceTime. In fact, the Russian interviewer, Babitsky, cited a clear parallel when he described Basayev as a terrorist, quote, more like the IRA than Osama bin Laden. The fact is, the IRA and its political wing Sinn Féin fought with the British government for 30 years over access to the media. Anne Cadwallader is a longtime British reporter in Belfast. She joins us now. Anne, welcome to the show.
And a welcome to you, Bob, from Belfast.
Anne, how did the British press initially deal with the rising violence in Northern Ireland?
Well, it was always a very difficult problem for the press because they wanted, on the one hand, to let people know why such violence was being carried out, but on the other hand, they didn't want to be seen in any way as sympathetic to it. Virtually every single news conference that Sinn Féin held, whether it was about the political situation, about policing, or about something as abstruse as farming or schools, there would always be a question from the media about how they could justify violence and always a question about when that violence would be brought to an end. Sinn Féin became very adept at answering questions about violence in a very reasonable-sounding way. We as journalists became very adept at asking questions in a very hostile way. But nevertheless, we all had to go through it time after time.
The media don't necessarily have to evince sympathy in order to be aiding a terrorist or a militant organization. Margaret Thatcher described the television coverage of the IRA as, quote, the oxygen of publicity. And she was prompted in 88 to change the rules for covering Sinn Féin and the IRA. Tell me about that.
Some British MPs, particularly those on the far right, did regard any kind of publicity for Sinn Féin, even if it was serious questioning, as some kind of justification for violence. And eventually, after an upsurge in violence in which a number of British soldiers were killed, there was a ban brought in, which meant that Sinn Féin interviewees could not be questioned live on air or recorded on air. What we ended up doing as broadcasters was hiring actors, often some penurious actors, at the start of their careers, and providing them with an unexpected bonus because they spoke the words of the Sinn Féin spokespeople and they were lip-synced into the pictures.
Was there any way to gauge the public's reaction to the theatrics of hiring people to mouth the words of militants?
People just sort of got used to it, you know, and you got used to the idea that Martin McGuinness's of Sinn Féin, his words would be spoken by one actor and Gerry Adams' words would be spoken by another actor. Sometimes his mouth seemed to be doing one thing and the words coming out were slightly different. That did appear absurd. And I think fairly soon the British government accepted that it wasn't working the way they'd figured it would. But nevertheless, they didn't withdraw that ban until the peace process began to bear fruit.
But isn't there something to the idea that any attention paid to terroristic acts is exactly what the terroristic acts were intended to produce?
Well, of course, politicians tend to look to the short term. And I suppose, in a way, what Margaret Thatcher got with her censorship, her ban on Sinn Féin, was a quick fix. But there aren't really any quick fixes to terrorism or to paramilitary violence. There can only be a long-term political fix. And I think, in the end, that lesson was learnt here. The ban had no effect, really, on what was happening on the ground, on the violence. It looked good. It was something she could say she'd done.
I guess it's easy to see why the Russians are infuriated to see the killer of children interviewed on a prominent American news program. But is it counterproductive for the government of Russia to decertify ABC News, to suppress news coverage of that movement?
Well, obviously, what happened in Beslan was horrendous and couldn't be justified by any normal standards. But I think in a situation where you have a civil war, both the society in which that war is being waged and outsiders internationally have a right and have a duty to inform themselves as to why this is going on, so that journalists and the state is not nannying people, is not thinking for people. Democracy requires that citizens inform themselves. And if journalists don't inform citizens, who else is going to?
Now, I understand that you're in Northern Ireland, but I assume you've been paying fairly close attention to the coverage of the London bombings. And I wondered if you noticed how the experience dealing with the IRA has informed the current coverage of the bombings.
Well, certainly Tony Blair shows no sign of intending to repeat the performance of Mrs. Thatcher's government in Northern Ireland by banning any one particular group. It seems that what he's going to be trying to do is change the law on incitement to hatred, maybe to take a more sophisticated and more subtle approach than the blunderbuss sledgehammer approach that we saw in Northern Ireland that just simply didn't really work in any way, shape, or form.
Okay. Well, Anne, thank you very much.
Thanks and goodbye.
Anne Cadwallader is a reporter for Independent Network News. She spoke to us from Belfast, Northern Ireland.
Coming up, the writers of reality TV seek protection, and the real-life foils of fake TV news.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, investing in nonprofits to help them catalyze growth, connect to stakeholders, and challenge greater support. On the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities. On the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Was a time when TV Guide was a kind of Bible for television viewers. If you wanted to know which bat channel to tune into, it was right there in those weekly listings. TV Guide announced recently plans to transform the magazine with pared-down listings and more emphasis on celebrity. Jeff Jarvis blogs at BuzzMachine.com and worked at TV Guide as both critic and developer. He joins us now. Jeff, welcome back.
Hey, Bob.
Jeff, the digest-sized TV Guide that we all remember as an iconic staple of our youth is no longer a viable business model. Why?
Well, the circulation has dropped from 20 million in its heyday to 9 million now, and now they're dropping it to 3.2 million guaranteed going forward. Some of that audience has died off, but a lot of that audience was junk circulation. My late father-in-law, a dentist, got 7 copies of TV Guide every week that he didn't ask for. Now TV Guide is going to get down to a realistic circulation of who really wants to buy and read the magazine.
Okay, now besides that, though, there is a structural editorial problem, and that is that the magazine was based on TV listings, a TV schedule that in many ways, you have written again and again and again, is increasingly irrelevant. Why are listings irrelevant?
because you can get better listings online that you can search for and make personalized, and there's far more power than there is to an old black and white page that's hard to read as we get older. The other issue is we now can watch anything we want to watch, whenever we want to watch, wherever we want to watch it, thanks to TiVo and our VCRs, and soon we'll be able to get the TV we want on our phones.
The new TV Guide will debut in mid-October. What are its chances surviving in a market that's already utterly glutted with celebrity news?
Well, having created one of those glutters in Entertainment Weekly, yes, there is a lot of coverage out there, but there probably isn't one that you can really say that is about TV, except, of course, Inside TV, which TV Guide just started. And we do need a critical guide to tell us what's neat and what's worth watching on TV.
Now, celebrity coverage is not new to TV Guide. It's been a staple all along. As a practical matter, has anyone really been using the listings the last 3 or 4 years?
I think the grandmothers of various listeners might still be using them, and that's probably about it. The idea of having listings in print is really outmoded. I saw the people who used to sit on the subways with their highlighter marking their whole week out, and their weeks are probably ruined now. But for the rest of us, it's really about a Googleifying of the world where we're going to search for what we want to watch, and then we'll watch it.
Yeah, in one word, Jeff, how would you describe a person who sits on the subway with a highlighter going over the TV Guide for his week's activity?
Loyal TV Guide reader.
Loser?
Yeah, no, you said it. You said it, you snob. You big media NPR snob, you.
That is correct. Jeff, as always, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Jeff Jarvis blogs at buzzmachine.com.
How do you just walk into a house and take a TV Guide? How does she expect you to watch TV? Am I just supposed to turn it on and wander aimlessly around the dial?
That, of course, was Frank Costanza, George's father, on the late great sitcom Seinfeld, a genre increasingly pushed aside in favor of the reality TV show. Why? One reason is that reality TV is cheaper to produce, partly because it doesn't employ pricey script writers. But according to the Writers Guild of America, reality shows do employ writers of a kind, people who piece together story arcs from hundreds of hours of raw tape for shows ranging from Big Brother to Project Runway to Battle of the Network Reality Stars, which debuts on Bravo Wednesday. And so the question is, should reality show story editors be recognized under the same union rules that protect traditional writers? Daniel Petrie Jr. thinks so. He's the president of the Writers Guild of America West, which has organized a class action lawsuit filed last month in Los Angeles Superior Court. Daniel, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you very much.
So I want to start with what seems to be the central premise of this lawsuit, that reality show editors and producers are, in effect, writers. I should mention that as president of the WGA, you're required to be a working writer, and among your credits are the movies Beverly Hills Cop and The Big Easy, one of my favorites. So,
thank you.
You're welcome. So make the case that what these reality show workers do is akin to what you do as a screenwriter.
In some cases on a reality show, they work from an outline of 100 pages. Whether they do it beforehand or after the fact by going through footage and putting things together, they're doing exactly what I do. They're creating compelling situations, suspense, comedy, drama, characters, certainly, and leave some things resolved and other things to get people to tune in next week. That's what the storytellers of reality TV do. They do it well, and they do it, unfortunately, without the benefits of a union contract. They don't get health insurance, for example. They don't get reasonable working conditions or any of the other things that writers who are, like me, under the Writers Guild umbrella receive.
And so you've collected over 1,000 signatures for this lawsuit, and they're employees of shows like The Bachelorette or something called Are You Hot? What sort of evidence will be submitted as part of the suit?
These people are contracted for 84-hour work weeks in some instances, and I have a pay stub which shows a writer who has an $800-a-week deal broken down into 40 hours of straight time at $7.41 an hour, 40 hours of time and a half overtime at $7.41 an hour, and 4 hours of guaranteed double time at $7.41 an hour, which is a violation of the law. And by the way, you know, just in terms of just human fairness, that's 12 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Why can't the reality show workers, if they're not strictly speaking screenwriters or TV writers, why can't they just form their own union?
They could, but they think it's appropriate that they're represented by the Writers Guild, and so do we. Listen, the Writers Guild represents screenwriters and traditionally scripted television writers, but we also represent writers who write questions for game shows, writers who write intros for 2020. We represent the groups of writers who write jokes for late night talk shows. So it's not a kind of one size fits all profession. There are many types of writing.
You know, one reason we're told why there are so many reality shows is that they're so cheap to produce, as little as half the price of a scripted show. And some argue that this lawsuit, if successful, will naturally drive up the cost of production and make it less likely that a network like ABC and CBS, who are defendants in this suit, will even gamble on a show like The Real Gilligan's Island, which is one of the programs named in the suit. Won't this end up hurting reality show workers?
No. First of all, we do not feel that bringing basic union protections such as health care will fundamentally alter the economic advantages of doing reality TV. I don't think that the companies would be doubling, tripling their costs by any means. I think it would be an incremental increase in their cost. And if every reality show producer needs to be part of a union environment, then no one company is at a competitive disadvantage vis-a-vis another.
So what's the best case scenario for you? What do you want the lawsuit to achieve? Damages, back pay, the recognition of reality show workers as writers, all of the above?
You know, we don't care so much about the recognition as writers, because part of the fun of reality TV is the belief that this is reality. So, you know, they can continue to call them story editors or associate this or that, or call them Matilda for all I care. Just so long as the union is recognized and we get to represent these storytellers and get them health insurance and the basic protections of the union contract.
Well, Dan, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.
Daniel Petrie Jr. is the president of the Writers Guild of America West and the co-author of the 1989 Tom Hanks movie, Turner and Hooch.
Reality TV has a corollary in reality-based fake TV news. If you've ever seen The Daily Show on Comedy Central or The Ali G Show on HBO, you're familiar with the conceit of the pretend journalist asking inane questions of real, if unwitting, public figures. It works, often to hilarious effect, only so long as the interviewee is, to some degree, unwitting. As in this interview, between mock hip-hop youth reporter Ali G and former national security advisor Brent Scowcroft.
Did they ever catch the people that sent Tampax through the post?
No, they did not. It wasn't Tampax, it was anthrax.
All right, I think there's different brand names. Like we say pavement, you say sidewalk, whatever.
Actually, Ali G's time in America may be over. His would-be victims know him now. In fact, recently one Republican Capitol Hill press secretary sent an email to all his GOP counterparts warning of Ali G. But what of The Daily Show? You'd think that with multiple Emmy and Peabody Awards and more exposure than at least one Hilton sister, producers would have run out of unsuspecting guests for its famous field reports. But they haven't. Stuart Bailey is co-executive producer of The Daily Show and has been with the program since its creation in 1996. Stuart, welcome to OTM.
Thank you very much. And by the way, we would be thrilled if we ever achieved the notoriety of at least one Hilton sister. That's still a goal for us.
Well, from your lips to God's ears. Stuart, give me a sense first of how these field reports come about. I mean, you have four or five faux correspondents. You find some story. Then what happens?
We actually sort of operate in a strange way, like an actual newsroom. We have researchers and associate producers and field producers who all gather information, pre-interview people, and we are sort of documenting a real story to some very thin extent. If it were a pure sketch, it doesn't work as well. And our audience, they have a very big fake meter. And if they don't sense that this is actually something in somebody's life or that it means something to somebody, then they lose interest very quickly.
When your field producers fan out to book these interviews, what exactly did they say to the prospective interviewees? I mean, you must employ some sort of bait-and-switch kind of ruse with prospective guests.
Not really. I mean, you would think so, but they kind of want to participate in this alternative reality, you know. And when you ask somebody a very silly question with a completely straight face, you will, by and large, get a straight answer, which is what we want. What we're really getting at is the journalist in a story who is so cocky, is so suave, is so smooth. No one's really like that. And so what if you got somebody that was really not very capable at all of even understanding a basic story, but yet sent them out to report on something? What would happen? And that's a lot of times the game that we're playing in an interview.
Okay, here's an example of that. This is Stephen Colbert interviewing Lonnie Randolph, president of the South Carolina NAACP, about its boycott of the Dukes of Hazzard movie because of the Confederate flag painted on the roof of the good old boys' 1969 Dodge Charger.
That flag is the universal symbol of bigotry, racism, and white supremacy.
Are you sure about that?
I am absolutely sure about that.
Even on a kick-ass car? Which is fun. It's on top of a car.
It was also fun to lynch black people at one time in this country. A lot of fun.
See, that's where you and I differ.
Now, I was going to ask you if interviews sometimes fall apart because folks are onto you and refuse to play along, but I'll bet it's much worse when they are onto you and they do try to play along.
Well, you wouldn't know it because we'll never use that. If somebody is trying to crack jokes, then that's the first thing that's on the edit room floor. So that's an easy problem for us to solve. The thing that we don't do is let people know exactly what our ultimate point of view is. I mean, we did a piece on election night that was our exit polling piece, and we felt that exit polls were not only sort of meaningless, but also invasive. So to get at that point, we decided to poll people as they were exiting anything. We found a guy that was coming out of a porn shop, and Samantha Bee walked up to him and said, "Excuse me, sir, can I have your full name and exactly what did you purchase in there?" And we had to put a bar over his eyes, but his eyes almost popped out. We want there to be as many natural moments as possible.
HBO has said there are no plans to bring back the Ali G show, partly because the joke has worn too thin and that too many people recognize him now. Do you think The Daily Show has to worry that at some point its profile will be so high that it really can't find any more stooges?
Stooges is an ugly word, Bob.
You're right. I apologize for that. Let's just say dupes.
If we really thought of it like that, we probably would worry. But almost always, the people that are involved in our reports are thrilled with them. They 99% of the time call us and say, "That was wonderful. My kids think I'm the coolest dad in the world now." And so if it weren't for that, I think we would worry.
Stuart, thank you very much.
Pleasure, Bob.
Stuart Bailey is the co-executive producer of The Daily Show on Comedy Central.
A few months back, Daily Show reporter Samantha Bee decided to take on the controversy surrounding Clint Eastwood's movie Million Dollar Baby, which ends shockingly with a mercy killing. She called Newsday film critic Gene Seymour, who at first thought they were going to talk about euthanasia, then learned it was going to be how film critics are spoilers who ruin surprise endings, and finally realized it was about something else altogether.
I kind of knew what to expect and that I was probably being set up for something, but it was my inclination to kind of play along.
Right.
Because, you know, I know how comedy works, and I knew that whatever they did, the important thing was for me to be as deadpan about it as possible.
What about better enforcement of spoiler alerts? Should we adapt a color coding system similar to Homeland Security?
Yes. I think using colors to denote the level of shock, the impact.
Don't look at my boobs.
I'm sorry. As you say, it certainly worked well in Homeland Security. It could also work well in defending people.
Don't look at them.
Your eyes are very nice.
Thank you. How are my boobs? See? You looked at them again.
So, your 15-year-old watches the show all the time. Is any of this going through your mind?
Yeah. And I guess part of what was going through my mind was that, well, because he is a 15-year-old son of mine, my embarrassment is by no means something that is necessarily undesirable to him, because we as parents embarrass him all the time. So this to him is kind of give back. Also, I know that at the moment, anyway, The Daily Show kind of rules the world in terms of TV comedy right now, and I just wanted to see just what it was like to be in that world, even if it is as kind of a comic stumble-bum foil. Only one person seemed to be grieving for my self-esteem. My God, didn't you know they were ridiculing you? Didn't you know they were setting you up? And I said, well, you're the only one who thinks that.
Was that your wife?
No. No, my wife, she found it bewildering, but she knew more than anyone else that I was not looking at her boobs.
But at some point there, and it seemed to me this was an efforted comedy at your part, you seemed to be making strides to definitely not look at her chest.
I guess I did try to consciously shift my eyes. You did notice that then,
mm-hmm.
right? I did. I was sort of thinking, okay, this is improvisational theater, and therefore one needs to kind of live in the moment. Professional funny people don't like it when amateurs are trying to out-funny them.
Right.
I knew that going in. And so I decided to be whatever it is they wanted me to be.
Film critic Gene Seymour writes for Newsday.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Volo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson our engineer. We had engineering help from Rob Christensen and other help from Sarah Dalsimer and Josh Nathan Kazis. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Are you looking at my boobs?
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org, the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the Foundation of Entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org, and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. Support for On the Media comes from the Lincoln Center, presenting the Mostly Mozart Festival, and the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.